Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Duncan Barrett. Duncan, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
The pleasure is all mine. So, Duncan, why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm an author. I usually write books about Second World War these days. I do sort of somewhere between social history and biography. Basically, my books generally based on interviews with people who've lived through certain shared experiences. But way back in, I think, 2000, the very first book I ever wrote was a book about Star Trek that I actually wrote with my mother when I was a teenager, still at school. And recently this year, because of the 50th and everything, they recently re-released it. So I've suddenly found myself back sort of talking Star Trek as well as my kind of usual patch, which is Second World War, generally women's history, Second World War. So I'm kind of wearing my other hat tonight.
The name of that book is Star Trek, The Human Frontier.
Star Trek, The Human Frontier. Sorry, that was a terrible plug on my part.
Yeah, I know you're supposed to mention that book so people can go and get it. And there'll be a link in the show notes.
Okay, brilliant. The website is www.startrekhumanfrontier.com. So you can find out all about it there.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about the book. What does the book cover?
So it covers a number of things. I mean, basically, the original version of the book obviously was written, as I say, right at the sort of tail end of the 90s. So it covered everything up to the end of Deep Space Nine and the sort of first 5 years of Voyager. So part of what I've been doing, or what we've been doing for the second edition, updating it, was to kind of try and weave in some stuff on the later years of Voyager and also some stuff on Enterprise, a little bit on the JJ verse as well. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Human Frontier because a big sort of central section of it is really about Star Trek's approach to humanism and what it means to be human and what the kind of boundaries of humanity are in Star Trek and in real world, science and our understanding of these kind of issues. But it also touches on a lot of other sort of more general cultural things. There's quite a big section about nautical literature. So, you know, Moby Dick and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and other kind of classic nautical literature, really, and the influence that had on Star Trek and on the kind of development of this, you know, this fleet of ships and this kind of nautical metaphor, really, that underpins Star Trek. And I suppose for us coming at it from a British perspective, I know that often, people talk about Star Trek as the wagon train to the stars, and that was always a big part of it. But there was always, from the very, very beginning, if you look at the 1964, the first pitch document that Gene Roddenberry wrote, there was also this idea of Star Trek as hornblower in space, was how they always described it. So there were always these kind of twin influences, one being the kind of, I suppose, very American Wild West influence, and the other being the more kind of European Age of Sail influence. So really for us, kind of coming from a British perspective, that was the angle that we wanted to look at more. So there's quite a lot of that in the book as well.
Oh, great. And so when I think about Star Trek, I'm an American, so I am biased, mm-hmm. because I think of it as a kind of distinctly American show. And when I'm thinking of kind of science fiction and British science fiction, the show that immediately pops to mind is Doctor Who.
Of course, yeah.
Now, are you also a Doctor Who fan?
I feel like a bit of a fraud. I never was a Doctor Who fan. I think that's partly just to do with my age, that, I was kind of growing up largely through that big sort of very long hiatus in Doctor Who, basically. So I did get into it. I mean, I do watch Doctor Who now. I've never really gone back. I've seen like a handful of the kind of classic Doctor Who episodes and enjoyed them, but I never really got into any of those. But yeah, I mean, once it started up again in whenever it was, the 2000s, I guess, I've kind of been watching it since then, and I enjoy it, but I'm not passionate about it, and I wouldn't say I entirely understand Doctor Who, I don't think, in the way that people who really care about it do.
I'm not sure
I still
I
find it quite baffling.
I think that's maybe part of its charm. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. That could be.
Now, you co-wrote this book with your mother, so that leads me to believe that she is also a Star Trek fan. So did she kind of...
She is, yeah.
Did she introduce you to Star Trek?
No, not really. Funnily enough, it was her sister and my cousins who live in Ireland, who kind of introduced both of us, I suppose. This was to the Next Generation. I'd kind of, when I was younger, there were always original series reruns on TV, and I'd sort of seen a handful of them, and, you know, kind of enjoyed it, but take it or leave it. But they really, when we would go and visit them in Dublin, I think because they had satellite TV, they would get the current run of TNG, which was airing at that time, way in advance of whenever the BBC were getting it. And so that's how they first piqued my interest, really. And then, to be honest, I was off school for quite a while when I was, I guess, about 11. I had a kind of bout of glandular fever, or mono, I think you call it. It's like one of these kind of illnesses that basically lays you up in bed for months on end. And that was when I was just deadly bored, essentially. You know, you've got no energy. I couldn't even really read a book. I was too tired. But I had just had my interest piqued in Next Generation in particular. So my mum would go out to the local Blockbuster video store every couple of days and get the latest. So I never really saw TNG on TV, in a sense. I'd get it off these VHS tapes. So she'd bring me the next bundle of VHS tapes and I'd lie in bed working my way through them. So by the time I'd recovered, basically, I think I was totally up to date on TNG. I think maybe by that point, DS9 was just starting as well. And so from then on, I was kind of pretty much hooked. And I guess because she was the one sort of feeding my habit, she was starting to get hooked along the way as well.
Oh, that's great. And so one of my standard questions that I ask everyone is what's your favorite series?
Yeah, it's a difficult one for me. And I actually, this 2016, I set myself this challenge to rewatch the whole of Star Trek from beginning to end. So I went back and watched, you know, in many cases, these were things I hadn't watched. I mean, obviously, there were like classic episodes I watched again and again, but then there were a lot of things I hadn't really seen since those original, you know, watching them way back when. And it was interesting. It's definitely between TNG and DS9 for me. I think there's kind of a real nostalgia factor for TNG, partly because that was sort of my Star Trek. That's what got me into it. And I think episode to episode individually, there are maybe more of those just really perfect, beautiful, you know, pieces of storytelling. But Deep Space Nine, watching it again, especially because that's a show that really benefits from the kind of, you know, from watching it from beginning to end, it benefits from that kind of putting the time in. Really, you know, watching the whole thing through last year, I was just constantly wowed. I was like, you know, God, I've forgotten how brilliant this program is, you know. And so I think they're hard to compare in that way, because they're both absolutely brilliant at what they do, but what they're doing is so different. So it's a toss-up for me between those two, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute comment, because, you know, I think they are also, as all Star Trek series, they're of their time, right? And so TNG was syndicated, as was DS9, but it was, you know, it did not bother with arcs, and basically you've had a feeling that it reset every episode, and they never really talked about, with some exceptions, anything that ever happened in any other episode. So you're kind of like, do you ever remember when, you know, Q came back last time, or you were a Borg for a while? Where DS9, obviously, it started in this which is now the default for TV shows, right? These kind of operatic long story arcs tricky for someone who runs a podcast where you watch random episodes.
That must be a challenge. Yeah,
it is, especially the later seasons when they have, like, you know, 9 episode arcs, and I'm like, well,
yeah.
This episode what makes no sense.
I guess you just do your best. Watch the previously on Deep Space Nine quite carefully.
Exactly.
You know, try to make sense of that. But actually, I mean, part of what I think I said this when we were talking on Twitter, but part of what attracted to me, I only discovered your podcast quite recently, but it was having gone through this process of watching from beginning, you know, watching everything in order, watching from beginning to end, not skipping anything out and so on, which was very interesting and an amazing experience. But, you know, a massive time commitment to do it in a year. I'm not sure if it's something I'll ever do again, but actually just the appeal of something where you just say, right, I'm just going to stick a pin in this and pick one at random and take it out of time, take it out of all that context, kind of strip all of that away, is really appealing to me. And I think, I mean, they're both, you get interesting stuff both ways, I suppose, but I think that's what's really great about Random Trek, is that you have this, it's quite a pure approach, I suppose, and it's like the sort of practical criticism of Star Trek rewatching, I suppose, this kind of, you know, do it randomly and just see what that throws up.
Exactly. That's part of the fun as well, because, you know, I know there are a bunch of podcasts that are doing rewatches in order, which makes perfect sense. But then you obviously know exactly what the next episode is because it is in order. Yeah. And so I like the chance of, and it harkens back to the time when people who are listening to this who are much younger than me do not remember this time when you had to turn on the television and whatever was on was what you were going to watch. So you couldn't watch any episode of Star Trek you wanted if you came across, you know, an original series episode that was just on the TV. That was the Star Trek you would watch because there it was.
Yeah.
And so I like
that. Well, and you still get that. I mean, I find I get that traveling now and then, you know, if I'm staying in a hotel or something and they have a channel that's, I can't remember what it's called. There is a channel over here that screens quite a lot of Star Trek reruns, like sort of all evening, basically. And I love that. I mean, you know, I've got them all on DVD. I've got Netflix. They're all on Netflix now. But at the same time, there's something quite appealing about just your channel hopping. And you're like, oh, okay, it's this episode. Yeah, you know, last time I was in Wales about a year ago, and I remember watching the Doomsday Machine, which I, you know, I don't know. It was just kind of just that chance aspect of it. It makes it, I don't know, it gives it an extra kind of excitement somehow.
Yeah, and it's a little
it popped out of the hat.
Exactly. It's a little, the serendipity is nice, and you don't have to, when I go on to Netflix or, you know, wherever you watch Star Trek, and I think, I want to watch an episode of Star Trek, and then you have every single episode you could choose from, and then you're like, which one, what series should I watch, and then which one should I watch? Yeah, yeah. It has to be a conscious choice. If you could just turn on the TV and it's playing, someone's already made that choice for you. And then you just watch.
Yeah.
Like here in America, we've got the BBC America, which for some reason plays Star Trek all the time. I don't understand why, but they do. And so you turn it on and it's either a TNG marathon or recently they've been doing Voyager marathons. Which is a nice segue. Even I did not plan this to the episode, in fact, that we are watching or we have already watched, which is a Voyager episode. Faces, season one, episode 14, apparently. So you didn't
right near the end of season one, I think, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Because they had this very truncated first season, so this is right at the kind of back end of it.
And this is so Voyager. What are your, before we talk about the specific episode, what are your thoughts about Voyager as a show?
I like Voyager as a show. I mean, again, there's an element of nostalgia to it. You know, I remember watching again because for some reason my cousins weren't sorting me out with videos at this point. But I watched Caretaker in I was at school at the time, and our biology teacher obviously had a satellite subscription, which I certainly didn't, and taped the first episode of Voyager Caretaker, and then brought it in, and we all stayed after school and watched it. So I have a kind of personal, I suppose, having watched it from the beginning and so on, these kind of early episodes of Voyager, although many people maybe would say that early Voyager is not their chosen Star Trek, it has a real appeal to me. And I found, you know, watching through those early seasons last year, there's a lot of kind of nostalgia in that for me. And I also, I liked, there's a kind of purity to, obviously the big issue with Voyager, I suppose, is Seven of Nine. Well, you know, how do you feel about Seven of Nine? And I felt conflicted about that because I think in some ways, a lot of the best writing of that show and what takes it up a notch does come after Seven of Nine is brought in. That did seem to kind of inject something, not just in terms of their viewing figures and everything, but it gave them, I don't know, they really did sink their teeth into her as a character, and I think that led to a lot of great stories. On the other hand, I do feel there's something quite pure about those early years of Voyager where, you know, they had their concept, they were kind of sticking to their concept. I think there was a real, you know, it was quite a sort of feminist statement in a way. They had this show that had not just a female captain, it also had, you know, we're talking about Faces, it also had a female chief engineer. It had a very sort of pure kind of Star Trek-y kind of optimistic approach to these characters. You know, they weren't sexualized at all, really. You know, neither Janeway nor B'Elanna is. You know, there was a kind of intention there that I think is quite honorable somehow. And even going back to some of those early episodes, even though they're sometimes a bit cringy, I think you see that. As you get into later Voyager, I think it is a different animal somehow. And, you know, I enjoy all those seasons, but for me, there is something kind of charming about these early seasons of Voyager, even if they're occasionally a little bit rickety.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, watching the first season of Voyager brings me back to when I was watching the first season of Voyager when it was on in America on, I think it was on UPN. It launched the network, I think. And I will admit I didn't super like it, but it was Star Trek, so I watched it. I did stop watching it at a certain point. But
well, for me, that was Enterprise. That was when I switched off. First season of Enterprise, actually. And I only, to be honest, I only went back and watched the rest of Enterprise about a year or so ago. So that was a long, long break.
It was a long road getting from here to there.
It was. Yeah, yeah, pretty long road. With a massive pothole in the middle of it.
Oh, man, that show. But we're not talking about Enterprise, so...
I have to say, having gone back and rewatched it, I felt maybe I was a bit harsh on it. And there are... I mean, I think there are a lot of problems with Enterprise, but there are things that are quite charming about it. And it I don't know, there are times when it made a real effort. There are episodes in Enterprise that I really like now. But, that one was a bit of a challenge, I think.
Yes, I don't hate Enterprise, but in my ranking, it is the lowest on the list for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
But I do think, so the first several seasons of Voyager suffer from, I think, two things. My main problem with Voyager is that they so quickly kind of, they had this great concept, right? They're lost, and they have to mesh these two crews together and find a way home. That's fantastic. But I feel like they mesh the crews together, like within the first three episodes, and then there's never much tension. And I feel like that's such a rich vein for storytelling they could have explored. But that's not really what they were trying to do, I guess. So
it's weird, though, because I've never really understood that. Because, yeah, you watch that show and you think, okay, that's not the show. They obviously knew what show they wanted to make. But at the same time, they've been setting, you know, this whole Marquee thing, they've been setting up in Deep Space Nine, they've been setting it up in TNG. It does feel like they were setting it up for, you know, at least in part for Voyager to kind of have this really strong, rich kind of conflict going on underneath it. And then maybe they just, I don't know, at some point they changed their minds, or they were different people working on different things and different priorities or something. But yeah, I agree. I mean, that's a massive missed opportunity. And I guess that's the thing about Voyager, is that it's not necessarily... I think with Enterprise, there are a lot of things that are just kind of cringingly, uncomfortably bad. The bad things are really, really almost unwatchable. Mm-hmm. I find even bad Voyager more watchable because I think it's more charming and it's got more going for it. But I think that there is often this sort of sense of missed opportunity. And especially when it's, you know, was running at the same time as Deep Space Nine, Deep Space Nine, you just feel like they take something and they make so much more than you'd expect of it. Do you know what I mean? So even like something like Vic Fontaine, you'd think it's a kind of silly concept, but they push and they push and they push and they get more and more out of that character, or, you know, lots of different plot strands and so on that you kind of think you've seen the last of, and then they come back in some interesting way or whatever. I feel like they're always kind of pushing and trying to do more. Whereas with Voyager, it just seems like they throw things out there and then kind of just forget about it. There's a lack of kind of a sort of vision shaping the overall thing. And it is partly that it's an episodic format compared to a more serialized format, but you know, they do serialization, they do try to do those kind of arcs and calling back to things. And also, actually, I mean, the weird thing is, if anything, you think Voyager should have been more serialized with that concept, and the fact that, you know, if serialization was happening on Deep Space Nine, you know, it's only like next door or whatever, they should have been aware of it.
Right.
And something like, you know, so this is an episode about the Vidians. I really like the Vidians as a villain. I mean, one of the things with Voyager, of course, is they have to move from one, like from one villain race to the next. But that actually could have been an opportunity to write an arc for each, you know, for each section of space that they're going through or whatever, to actually have a shape to that and work out, you know, what is the story that's going to last for a season or half a season or whatever it is, and find a way of doing it, rather than it just being like, okay, this is the sandbox we've got to play in for, you know, this period of months, and then at some point we're going to jump some number of light years, and so basically throw all those toys out and we've got to start with a whole new set of toys. But basically it's kind of just almost like reinventing the world of the show each time, rather than using that as an opportunity to kind of have any sort of forward momentum somehow. I don't know, which is weird for a show where they are literally going in the same direction the whole time.
it
feels a bit aimless sometimes. You know?
It does. And I think that it is interesting when you think about it, because Deep Space Nine, as you said, is running at the same time as Voyager. So they're contemporaneous shows, and they are just so vastly different. And Voyager feels to me, and it always has, and I like a lot of characters on Voyager. I really like Janeway. I think she's one of my favorite characters in Star Trek.
Yeah.
But it kind of feels like TNG light. Because I really like, you know, Janeway is all about, she has to make tough decisions, but she still has a set moral compass, and she's a Federation officer, a Starfleet officer, so she kind of knows right and wrong, but she has to make tough decisions, and sometimes she has to make a decision she normally wouldn't make because she is cut off and far away and she needs to get everybody home. I think they could have done a lot more with that, but... Oh, well.
Definitely. No, I mean, I agree. I suppose Year of Hell is kind of the closest they got to that. And I mean, it's funny that is so far pushing the envelope. And yet, consistently, that's, you know, one of the tiny handful of episodes that is, you know, always ranked as Voyager's best episode. It's the one the fans really love. And I think with that, there was some talk. I think maybe some of the writers wanted to stretch that out and do, maybe not a whole year, but, you know, to stretch that out into more of an arc.
Right.
But there was kind of pushback from the network. And I suppose that's another aspect of it that, to be fair to them, they were the kind of flagship show for UPN, I think, weren't they?
Yes.
So they were maybe this kind of TNG light thing. It may have partly been there was an element of pressure coming down. Don't shake up the formula. Don't mess with this too much. You know, whereas on Deep Space Nine, they were kind of the middle child show. They could kind of...
Right. Nobody cared what they were maybe, doing.
No one really cared. Exactly. And I think they didn't really have the ratings necessarily quite as high. There was a kind of, you know, just leave them, let them get on with it. They're doing something a bit weird over there. But Voyager's the one kind of carrying the torch in a sense. And with that comes that level of pressure and kind of interference and playing it safe, I suppose. I guess that's part of it, not taking enough risks.
Right.
But having said all that, I mean, this episode we're looking at now, Faces, is, you know, you were saying you want it to be dark. Is really dark,
this one is
really
pretty
weird.
Dark.
Kind of, I mean, this is, it kind of stands out because it's not soft. You know, you think of Voyager as quite soft Star Trek, and it's quite gruesome and horrific in some ways. So,
it is, and you were talking about the Vidians, who are the villains in this episode, and I agree with you totally. They are, I think. When I think of Voyager and the people that they had to fight along the way, when Seven of Nine comes aboard, it's basically all Borg all the time. And I think they went to that well too many times. And I hated the Kazon. I did not think they were interesting at all. But the two that I really liked are the Vidians and the Hirogen. And I think they're both fascinating. The Vidians in particular are unlike any kind of alien race we've seen before in Star Trek, in that they are these kind of horrific, mutilated, although they're suffering from a disease that kind of warps their body, so I guess they're not actually mutilated. And they feed on this kind of body horror, and they steal organs. So there's a lot of creepy stuff that they do that makes them very good villains.
They look creepy and they act creepy.
And they want to take your internal organs.
Take your organs. I know.
Which, you know, I don't want anyone to take my organs.
No. And I mean, it's also, you know, there is an element of sympathy for them as well, because they, you know, you do get this sense that they're in this desperate situation, aren't they? They're not, they're not like the Kazon, who are just basically, you know, arseholes, really. Kind of like kind
it's
of
true.
Klingons, or, you know, but taken to an extreme, or even the Hirogen, who they're, you know, they're obsessed with hunting and so on, which is, I don't know, for me anyway, hard, you know, it's hard to kind of, that's like an alien cultural thing that is dictating their behavior. I suppose the Vidians, the sense is like they're, I suppose the idea is we're supposed to think that's where we could, you know, if we were desperate enough, what would we be pushed to this kind of behavior? You know, it is a kind of a bit like you see in that the Voyager episode where they meet the other Federation ship, the Equinox. They meet the other Federation ship, and they've started doing these awful experiments on these aliens in order to try and get themselves home faster. You know, they were in a desperate situation, and they started abusing these other species to try and get them out of it. You know, it's that same kind of right. can and, sort of understand where they're coming from.
And the Vidians are pretty much, they mirror the situation that Janeway and the Voyager crew are in a certain way, right? Mm. That they're just desperately looking for a solution and to go back home, which is before they all suffer from this phage and they want to go back to the way everything was before.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just trying to, you know, I don't know why they don't ask people for help. They just kind of steal people. But maybe Vidians don't like to ask for help. I don't know.
Well, in the end, I think we find out that they're, because they mentioned them years later in Think Tank, which is, what is it, maybe like season 5, I think, something like that. So it's quite a bit, you know, some years after they've left them behind. They mentioned the phage has been cured, and since it's this think tank who are kind of hired by people to solve problems, I suppose the implication is that the Vidians did get hold of them and, you know, offer them something in exchange for solving this problem for them. So I guess in the end, maybe they you know, kind of mended their ways in a sense, or at least, you know, decided they weren't going to work it out themselves with the mad science experiment. they needed a bit of help.
Failing for so long. Yeah, and it's interesting. So the Vidians have all this advanced medical technology because they've been trying to cure themselves. And as they're doing that, they're, you know, melding other people's alien body parts and things to themselves so that they can continue to live. So they have an interesting weapon that's like a medical a tricorder plus a phaser plus like a transporter all in one thing. They're pretty gruesome characters.
They are, yeah. And never more so than in this episode.
Yes, this is the main bad guy. What's his name? Sulin, something like that?
I think so, yeah.
So basically, let's jump into the episode. This is they capture Tom Paris, B'Elanna Torres, and what's his name? Hutch? Hastings? Something. Some other guy.
AKA crewman red shirt.
Yes. Who you know is going to die. Yeah. They're off exploring some cave somewhere for some reason. And the Voyager heads back to go pick them up. And oh no, they're not there. And it starts with a scene of someone on a table. And it's revealed. There's some creepy music. And then it's revealed that it is none other than B'Elanna Torres. But it is a fully Klingon B'Elanna Torres. And you're like, what's going on? OMG.
And then, it's one of those kind of, you know, very short teasers, like a sort of, you know, 10-second teaser that they like to do now and then to just kind of, you know, pull you in with very little setup, just with a sort of shocking visual, I guess. Yeah.
Yes. And then we get switch. This Klingon B'Elanna. And then there's a tonal shift, and we shift to Voyager, and Tuvok is eating soup. It's very strange. We don't even need to talk about that. except that Neelix is annoying, as always. Even early Neelix
screws up the soup. Yeah.
Is
I have to say, I know you hate Neelix, because I've listened to quite a few of your Voyager discussions. I feel I should... I mean...
Are you going to stand up for Neelix?
He's not my favorite character. I find it quite hard not to have a bit of a slight soft spot for Neelix, and I think it's partly because... the only Star Trek convention that I've ever been to it was a really big one. They did it at the Royal Albert Hall in London. It was before the 30th, I think, but I don't know. Anyway, it was a big celebration, and they had people from all the different series and so on. And this was Voyager was being, it was like in preparation, but no one had seen anything of it yet. So it hadn't aired yet. And the representative, I think, from Voyager was Ethan Phillips. And so no one knew anything about his character. No one knew who Neelix was. They didn't know a thing. Just this kind of, you know, quite cheerful, chubby guy came on stage and started telling stories and chatting. And this huge audience were completely in the palm of his hands. He just seemed like such a nice guy and really kind of, you know, pleased to be doing the Star Trek thing and really kind of excited about it all and so on. So for me, when I first started watching Voyager, I couldn't kind of get out of my head the fact that this seemingly very nice man kind of, you know, introduced himself and talked about how excited he was to be doing it and so on. So I guess for me, there's always, I have a slight soft spot for Neelix because that was my sort of introduction to that character almost.
Well, and I should say that I actually like the actor, who Ethan Phillips. I think he's a good actor. I've seen him in a bunch of other stuff, and I enjoy him.
Right.
I just don't like the character Neelix.
No. Fair enough. That is understandable, I think.
and plus, it's not all... I don't think it's much of Ethan Phillips' fault. I think that the writers kind of once again an opportunity. Neelix is kind of this guy who is not, he's a fish out of water, and he's trying to figure out a way to integrate in this crew and to become useful, and there could have been some tension, but he just kind of, and he's dating a 4-year-old, which is weird, but,
that is weird how we look at it,
But so luckily there's not much of Neelix in here, although there is another Talaxian, which leads me to believe that all Talaxians are annoying.
It does seem that way, doesn't it? And I think, I'm guessing this is only the second one we've seen by this point in Voyager. I can't think when, I mean, I think we do get one or two later on, but yeah, they definitely seem to have a type.
Yes, and it's not a type I like. But I haven't met all not all Talaxians. #NotAllTalaxians. So basically, the crux of this episode is the Vadians are mining something on this planet. It's unclear what they're doing, but they are so weak that they can't do it themselves. So they kidnap people and then do two things with them: either take up to the organ harvesting room and take their organs, or force them to work until they are so weak that they are taken to the organ harvesting room and their organs are harvested. It doesn't end well anybody. Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
So we have B'Elanna has been taken by their chief medical officer guy, and he has split her into two components, basically one full Klingon, one full human, which they reveal a little bit later. And he explains that he's done that because he feels like, his research has led him to believe that Klingons are resistant to the phage, which is the disease that has ruined his society. And so he needs to test it to see, and he needs a full Klingon. And so he made her into a full Klingon. And then she's like, well, how are you going to know if I'm resistant? And in another, and he's a pretty creepy, they did a good job with this character. He's very creepy.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, I infected you with phage, very casually. And you're like, whoa, this guy, maybe we shouldn't trust him. And so it's interesting. And this is one of those episodes where, you think about transporters and are you the same person after you have transported? Because, a copy of you is destroyed and then you're recreated. And so this plays with that because she's split into two people. So the B'Elanna Torres is, one imagines, destroyed and then kind of replicated into two different people. And one, her Klingon side is, aggressive and sexual, apparently, because she tries to seduce the Sulan. And then her human side is very timid and thoughtful and wants to think through things. This episode also gives us an opportunity to explore B'Elanna's character. And she talks about how, she always hated being half Klingon because she was at this colony and she was unlike everybody else, and the Klingon Empire and the Federation at that time didn't have great relations, so nothing was ever done to her, but she always felt like people were looking at her, so she tried to hide her heritage, and she often thought, wouldn't it be great just to be a human? So this episode also deals with this theme that I think everyone has experienced where, you just wish a part of you was different. Like, you could cut out a part of you and you'd be much happier. And then we find out, of course, I think the lesson of this episode is that you are more than the sum total of your parts and that you have to accept all of you to be the same person that you are and all that good stuff.
Basically, exactly what we had in the original series with the enemy within, when Kirk was split in two and then had to accept both parts. One of the things I think is slightly strange about the episode, I suppose it makes sense, but B'Elanna Torres, the Star Trek Voyager character, is not in this episode. I mean, it's a kind of interesting decision, and I think that marks it apart from all the other episodes. You've got Tuvix in Voyager, you've got you've got the enemy with it, you've got lots of episodes where there's a duplicate version or a kind of someone split in two or someone's combined with someone else, whatever. I'm not sure if there's ever another one where you don't at any point in the episode see the actual character who is who this is happening to, because it's kind of strange. So the very first in the teaser, it's this hokey, and this may be the reason for it, is because the kind of the premise of the episode is slightly silly potentially, and that they've managed to kind of put it either side of the episode itself so that you never actually have to see it happening. But so we start off with the split having already taken place, and then mm-hmm. the end of the episode, it finishes before she's actually reintegrated, which is kind of interesting, I think. So we have Roxanne Dawson playing both the human B'Elanna and the Klingon B'Elanna, but we don't in this episode ever see her playing B'Elanna. But I did find that kind of interesting, and the fact that we don't see the you know, the usual kind of hybrid mixed species B'Elanna at all, maybe sort of encourages us to put the human B'Elanna in the place of that character and to treat her as that character, whereas actually she's as much a different character as Tuvix is from Tuvok or Neelix, in a sense. You know, she is a new character, but she's treated as the one that we've known all this time.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that even, you know, to further prove your point there, is that the human B'Elanna is wearing her Starfleet uniform, right? And the Klingon B'Elanna is not. She's like wearing some random clothes I guess they had around.
Definitely.
And so, yeah, it's certainly, and maybe that's, you know, the kind of the struggle, the classic struggle for B'Elanna that we've seen in many other franchises of Star Trek, is that she's these two parts and she has trouble integrating them. And the thing that about B'Elanna is, right, she has these dual parts of herself, and she doesn't accept fully the Klingon part. And like you were saying, it got her kicked out of the academy and all this stuff. But then the Klingon part of her says, well, that was actually good because it got you here. They escape. The only way they escape and save the day is by working together. So one assumes that B'Elanna has learned a valuable lesson, although I think she still continues to struggle with it because she doesn't quite like the, you know, the Klingon side of her, and what she feels is kind of, you know, like the blunt instrument that is the Klingon, whereas the human side is more nuanced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. The other thing that I noticed, though, having recently, you know, watched Voyager through to the end, is that I feel like the human, in terms of the performance that she gives, and in a way, this is, you know, the actress having to do this quite after only like whatever it is, 12 or 13 episodes to get to know the character beforehand. Mm-hmm. I feel like the character that she portrays in the human B'Elanna does reappear over and over again in Voyager. It's basically, that's the character that she plays when B'Elanna has gone through some difficult emotional experience in an episode, got really angry, screamed at everyone, kicked up a fuss, and then basically broken down. And that's kind of what's left. Do you know what I mean? You get those scenes where sort of she shows that softer side. That is exactly the same performance that we see there, in a sense. And it's kind of interesting to think of that so specifically as, okay, that's, you know, that is the human side, sort of without the Klingon. You wouldn't think that watching those episodes. You just think this is like a person, and they, you know, they behave differently in different situations, and she's, you know, that's a kind of emotional breakdown. But it's kind of interesting just watching it with that in mind, and seeing the way the actress performs these different aspects of the character. They seem to sort of line up like that.
Yeah, and I think it's clear that if B'Elanna had a choice, even after this experience, she would probably willingly give up her Klingon side and just be a human, because she feels like, well, she's an engineer, right? And that's not really a super Klingon-y thing. She's not super interested, but then she still has kind of the reactions of a Klingon. So she gets angry very quickly, which, you know, when you're trying to manage a team, is not the greatest way of doing things.
No. That's true.
So especially, and she's on a Federation ship. So, I think, but this episode makes it pretty clear. And I will say a shout out to her for, because I think she did a great job of. She even changed like the way she, like her, the timbre of her voice when she's in full Klingon mode versus human mode. So, and I thought she did a really good job of playing both of those characters. So kudos to her. And we should talk about. And so, I mean, spoiler alert, she gets reunited and everybody's happy. But the doctor basically has a kind of a crush on her. Not the doctor, the holographic doctor, but the Vidian doctor.
That would
be interesting. Yes. Because she tries to seduce him to get to escape. And he says, well, I know you're disgusted by me. And kind of a nice scene. I mean, it's a creepy scene, but he's like, you know, I know I look horrific on the outside, but I actually, there's a person inside here and I have feelings, and don't play with me like that. And then you're starting to feel kind of bad for him. until he decides the way to make B'Elanna like him is that he will kill the crewman, whose name I don't remember, and take his face. Yes, Durst, yes. And take his face and graft it onto his face and then show up and say, hey, B'Elanna, do you want to make out now?
which I think may be, you know, a mile, probably the most horrific scene in, I suspect, the whole of Voyager. possibly up there for the whole of Star Trek.
Yes, I was about to say
definitely
that.
A kind of like, real, you know, proper horror, really, coming into it.
Yeah, and
I think I read on Memory Alpha that the writer of the episode said this, he thought that scene was basically his best work, certainly in the first season of Voyager. That was his, that moment was the kind of thing he was proudest of.
And it is, I mean, this episode overall, I think, is a fine episode. I don't think it's my favorite episode of Voyager ever, but it is that scene, and just, it is worth watching just for that scene because it is so horrific and the makeup is so well done. That you really, it does really look like they basically just ripped this guy's face on and slapped it on with a little tape. You could just feel the character being like, I did this for you, and you don't appreciate it. And it's horrific.
Well, because you can kind of, you can see the train of thought that's led to it from his perspective, but you also, it's just such a horrifying thing to do. And also, it's quite an effective, bit of makeup. I hadn't realized till watching it this time that it's actually the same actor, which makes a lot of sense, because I always thought, wow, what an amazing makeup job. They kind of they created a mask off that man's face and then plastered it on top of someone else, but it's actually the same guy playing both characters. So in a sense, that when he's the Vidian with the human face on top, the human face is the only bit that's not artificial, in a sense, like that is his actual face,
right?
But it is, it's no, it's a shocking moment.
It is shocking, and it doesn't work. So, tip for you people out there who are trying to get in good with somebody and it's not working, don't find someone they like and cut their face off and put it on yours. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's if you learn nothing at all from Random Trek.
That's the message of the episode.
Yes. It is not a great seduction tool.
No.
And there's some nice, like they dress up Chakotay as a Vidian, and it leads me to think that the Vidians don't have great security processes, because they're like, I've never seen you before. And he does have a clever line. He's like, well, I just went through facial reconstruction. And they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, it checks out. Everybody gets off and goes back to Voyager. And they do, I do want to talk about the last scene, basically, is... Mm. The doctor says, well, I'm going to make you a half Klingon again. apparently, it's super easy to do. There is a moment where you see B'Elanna think about if she actually, like, she doesn't verbalize this, but you can see it in her face. Like she's wondering, do I actually want to have that other side back? I feel like they could have made a whole nother episode just about her struggle to decide if she actually wanted to reintegrate or not. But they don't.
I mean, one of the things about this, I like this episode a lot, but I think it does feel a bit rushed. There's so much kind of plot and kind of coming and going and escaping from the prison and so on, that in a way, maybe compared to some of those other episodes of Star Trek that deal with this kind of split identities or, who is this person or the person, two people combined, all these things. I feel like all those kind of existential things, they're in there, but they feel a little bit rushed maybe. So I agree with you. I think it would be great to sort of have more of that. I suppose you get more of it as Voyager goes on now and then, in terms of, we do sort of come back to this issue of B'Elanna and her, the relationship between her human and her Klingon sides, but never in such a direct, kind of sci-fi way as this, I suppose.
Right. And I think this is a good episode too. I think it probably would have been better as a two-parter, where they could have had the kind of the abduction and the escape. And then the cliffhanger is, they beam up, but B'Elanna's Klingon side has been killed. And they have to figure out, they have to track down a Vidian and get their help to reintegrate her. And then she has to struggle with if she wants to or not. Because it's kind of like the doctor, we know as Voyager watchers that the Vidians have this advanced medical technology. And the doctor in this episode is like, oh, I came up with this new experimental process to split you. And then the doctor, the hologram doctor, is like, oh, I can totally fix you. It's like a normal thing that I do.
Yeah.
which seems kind of weird.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. They just kind of had to finish the episode. And so they're like, well, the doctor will fix it, and the next episode she'll be fine.
Yeah. And we never have to see that, I suppose, because it happens sort of in that gap.
Right. Which is an interesting, I think it's an interesting decision, and I'm sure they knew that it wasn't going to be a two-part episode. So basically, I like the fact that they didn't try to jam in even more, because it would have made it even more rushed. But I do kind of feel like they could have maybe cut a little of the, like, the Tom Paris scenes and focus more on B'Elanna. But
it's quite a downbeat ending. I suppose what they managed to do by not showing her back together, I guess if they bring her back together again, it sort of feels like, okay, and everything's fine and it's all resolved and here she is. But in fact, that final scene, it's kind of weird because the very end of the episode, she has this scene with Chakotay, who we know is this, you know, old long-standing friend, close friend of hers. And he's sort of trying to comfort her, but at the very end, it sort of looks like he doesn't quite know what to say, and then he just wanders off, and then she's just left there kind of crying and stroking her forehead.
Right, yeah. Yeah, this is a big thing, but we can't really deal with it. So.
Yeah, but don't expect to hear about it again.
Exactly. We will never mention this again, but we realize this would have had large repercussions. Well, Duncan, thank you so much for joining me and chatting about Faces.
That's all right. It's a pleasure.